Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How does your culture affect your mental health or your mental illness? We spend the hour with three top scholars. Joining us is Roberto Luis Fernandez. He is professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, director of New York State Center of Excellence for Cultural Competence and Hispanic Treatment Program, co-director of Anxiety Disorders Clinic at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. He's also the author and co-editor of the book DSM-5R, Handbook of the Cultural Formation Interview, and co-author of the publications Impact of Motivational Pharmacotherapy on Treatment Retention Among Depressed Latinos. Tanya Marie Luhrmann is the Watkins University professor in the anthropology department at Stanford University. She's the author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. Of Two Minds, an anthropologist looks at American psychiatry and our most troubling madness, schizophrenia and culture. Andrew Ryder is also with us. He is a professor of psychology and co-director of the Center for Clinical Research in Health at Concordia University. He's the author of Revisioning Psychiatry, Cultural Phenomenology, Critical Neuroscience, Global Mental Health, Depression and Cultural Context, Chinese Somatization, and Toward a Cultural Clinical Psychology. So welcome to the Scholar Circle. It is so great to have the three of you here with us. Given that I think people haven't really thought this through in the general public as much as perhaps we should have, I thought we could start with a sort of 101 general, how do these things interact, these dynamics, culture on mental illness, and how it affects our approach. Andrew Ryder, would you like to start?
Sure. I guess the short answer to your question is we haven't necessarily figured it all out either. This is something I think all of us have spent our entire careers thinking about, and it always throws up new challenges. What I'd like to emphasize is that there's different layers of thinking about the problem. A superficial layer, I don't mean unimportant, but something like if you come from a different cultural background, you might not speak the same language, your clinician might not understand you, you may be worried about prejudice and discrimination, and maybe rightly so in some cases. But you can dig deeper than that too. And actually, the more you dig, the more you can see that there are really some quite profound differences between people who have grown up and lived in different cultural environments, different ways of understanding emotion, even different ways of thinking and perceiving the world. And those can end up having some quite profound implications for mental illness, so that the causes can be different, the symptoms can be different.
Making the treatment different too.
Right, exactly.
So I wonder, before we talk further about this, if you would give us maybe one example from your work.
So the area I've looked at most is symptom presentation in people living in China compared to people living in Canada or the U.S. I'm located in Canada. For a long time, people had observed clinically that Chinese immigrants, for example, or even people in China were emphasizing the somatic or the physical aspect of their experience much more than the psychological. And this goes back to work that was done by Arthur Kleinman in the 1970s. And so it's been around for a while, and it has really interesting implications. On the one hand, what does it mean for our construct of depression, or that labeled depression, if the symptoms in one part of the world can be actually quite different than the symptoms somewhere else? And then it has some pretty practical implications too. So if someone comes, especially here, and says, look, I have a headache, I have a stomach ache, you know, my life's not going so great, but really they're emphasizing the physical symptoms, the likelihood that they'll get sent to family medicine or internal medicine for help rather than psychiatry or psychology is much higher. And then if they do show up to psychiatry and psychology, both the mental health professional and the patient might wonder why they're there. But in fact, dig deeper and you can see interpersonal problems and life stresses and push a bit, and there might be shame or guilt or some hopelessness as well, but it's not the primary way that the symptoms are experienced.
Which could also be what's acceptable, what's not acceptable in each culture.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So a particular emotion might be more acceptable in one place than another. For example, Arthur Kleinman pointed out that especially back in the 1970s, you talk a lot about being hopeless about the future. then you're actually engaging in bourgeois sentimentality that is critiquing the project of the Communist Party. If you say you have a headache and a backache, that might get you some time off work. So what are you going to emphasize? And at a certain level, it's not just that you choose to emphasize one, that you might actually, your experience might start getting shaped by this as well. So you spend a lot of time focusing on your body and what's going wrong with it, because you can get things done by talking about physical symptoms.
Roberto Luis Fernandez, you've been working on this for a very long time. I saw your articles dating back to the 90s about incorporating culture into mental health and mental illness. What would you add to this?
I think that's an excellent summary. I would add something that we tend to forget, which is that what we consider a normal mental health or psychiatric or psychological way of looking at the situation, looking at illness, looking at healthcare systems, is also culturally based, so that it isn't only that other people have particular, if you will, funny ways of looking at things. We also have funny ways of looking at things which seem completely normal to us. And one, for example, that I have become more and more aware over time is the key commitment that at least my profession as a psychiatrist has made over the years to focusing on what's inside the body, if you will, what's physical about the situation, as though that explained lots about the suffering that the person is experiencing. And it's true that what the brain is doing at the time is important, and there are some illnesses that have very strong physical roots, but many more, if you will, or more of many of them, is another way of saying it, of the illnesses we consider, really have quite social and interpersonal roots. And the profession has made, in some ways, a cultural commitment. It's a fruitful one. Most cultural commitments are fruitful, but we've made a fruitful cultural commitment to essentially kind of ignore that, or not ignore it, put it in a second plane and focus on the way that kind of experience in the world, adversity, social structure and all that affects our suffering. So that's a cultural commitment. I'm not trying to say it's not important to examine the mechanisms of suffering in the body, but there is also something tremendously important, which our patients keep telling us, that their depression, their anxiety, their whatever are rooted in very adverse social experiences, which we tend to check off as precipitants, but then go back to focus on the way the body works. They're both very important.
You know, it makes me also think about the idea of brain plasticity and, you know, the idea that your body responds to these adverse effects that you are talking about. I wonder about that dynamic. Is that something that you've also looked at?
I look at it a little bit, but I also look at the other side that Andrew, I mean, it is something of interest of mine, but I'm just wondering it as I'm mentioning it as a cultural commitment, as a field as a whole. But the thing that Andrew also mentioned that I would maybe take the opportunity to continue to express is how recursive, if you will, our own interpretations are on our experience. So it's like there's this loop that where precipitants happen, we have a particular temperament, a particular biology, things start happening, and then we make sense of the things that are happening to us. Andrew was explaining the example of physical symptoms. I've worked on other examples, such as notions of control and how you're supposed to control yourself, and you hold emotions in, and then you let them out all in a hurry, this kind of a pattern. But it's just an interpretation that we make of our own experience, and that interpretation then tends to affect how we actually experience a situation. So if we experience an emotion as scary or as inappropriate, then we may actually try to hold in that emotion, and that leads to a certain kind of accumulation and a certain kind of experience about, in the case of the work that I was doing, a certain form of paroxysm, a kind of blowing up of emotionality that the person may have because they've interpreted the original experiences as inappropriate or scary or, you know, the wrong thing to say to the right, to a certain kind of person or in the family or whatever. So all that matters in terms of how experience is patterned.
So it's really what you're talking about, what both of you have said so far, pertaining to what we think it means. It's about the meaning of it.
Yes. The meaning matters tremendously, both in what the clinicians and other providers do and in what the people who come for help understand is happening, not only in the way they ask for help and expect treatment, but even in the ways they experience it in their lives.
Tanya Lerman, let's bring you in about this too. Your work even goes to look at both voices in our heads and how that is treated differently cross-culturally. What kind of wisdom do you bring from this?
So I think my two colleagues have spoken very well. My own tagline is to say that culture shapes the way that mental illness is recognized, experienced, and treated. And that there's a great invitation in our audience, for the reasons that Roberto Luis Hernandez describes, to imagine that as, you know, the mental illness is a thing, and it's either well recognized or not recognized, or maybe it's experienced a little bit differently, and people have different styles of treating it. But there's basically a thing-like quality to mental illness. And it's not that that's wrong. I mean, I'm certainly no opponent to that. I mean, you work with somebody with who meets criteria for schizophrenia, and it's evident that it feels like there's a process in the body. But I also think that the evidence is clear that the meaning people give to their experience changes the process of the experience. And where I have seen this, where I think I've seen it most clearly, is in talking to people who meet criteria for schizophrenia, which is our most caustic psychiatric disorder, or arguably, a disorder in which people often have auditory and quasi-auditory experiences. They often feel as if they are in a beehive of bombarding sound. And one of the things that I have done is to talk to people in different parts of the world who meet criteria, who everybody agrees are very ill. And I say, what do you hear? And people report somewhat different experiences, not radically different. This is not a romantic story. But in the States, where people, I think, imagine their minds as their citadel, their own special place, and it's like central to who they are, when they hear voices, it's arguably uniquely or just very, very upsetting. They tend to hate their voices. And when they tell me what they experience, what they call to mind are the worst, most difficult auditory events that they experience. So when people fall ill, they probably have an array of auditory phenomena. Bad, good, loud, soft, commanding, whatever. Inside the head, outside the head. Americans, at least in the research I've done, seem to remember the worst kinds of voices. And then when they, and I think those experiences habituate for them, in Ghana, people seem, are highly motivated not to attend to negative voices. Mm. They are motivated to experience their voices more positively. They remember the positive experiences. In South India, in my samples, people remember their voices as people, and the voices do what those people do, which is that they hear their kin, and their kin tell them to clean up and not to drink and not to smoke and give them good advice, and they can be very annoying, but they are annoying in a familial kind of way. So my hunch is that these differences that people are reporting are real differences. And there are, I think it's more, because I've now talked to so many people, and my colleagues have talked to so many people, that there are different, at least, memories of the voice hearing experience. And it's possible that the very caustic experiences that Americans report may not be good for them, may be worse for them than experiencing their voices in a more positive way.
That's fascinating too, because we do all naturally internalize some kind of conversations in our head. And it sounds like what you're saying is that in these other cultures, the voices are just sort of an extension of that.
So one of the things that I think we know, I think that the science suggests that conditions like schizophrenia are very messy, that they exist kind of on a continuum, and there are some people who are very, very ill and some people who are less ill. One of the things I think I've also begun to see is that this old romantic idea that anthropologists used to believe in and then was kind of abandoned as biomedical psychiatry became the dominant paradigm that we use to think about mental illness. So I'm now more sympathetic to this kind of old idea that people who are not dramatically ill, but might be, you know, might have the kind of process in the body that might make them, might make it difficult for them to function effectively in a Western setting. Sometimes there is a role for them in other settings. And so last summer, I spent time in Ghana with people who practice a traditional religion, and they're described as a Komfu, and they talk to the gods. And so the gods are meant to talk back. So we have a project in the region. We've had a bunch of people who practice the traditional religion were interviewed by our team. And then I went in and talked to a small number of them more carefully. And I thought that many of these people had nothing that looked like what a psychiatrist might call psychosis or schizophrenia. And of course, they don't meet criteria because they're not ill. They don't experience distress, and other people don't regard them, well, they seem not to regard them as being unusual, because these traditional practitioners are a little odd. Anyway, but some of the folks I spoke to, they sounded a lot like the people I've met in this country or in America, who do meet criteria for schizophrenia. And although they're not distressed, they don't actually meet criteria, but these are people that some of the Akomfu had a lot of voice hearing experiences and a lot of good and bad experiences that they were able to interpret and incorporate into a system of meaning, which they were able to use for them in a more or less effective way. So I really think that meaning matters to the way that some people.
How does this relate to your work, Voices of God, in the U.S. setting?
So I'm engaged in an argument with colleagues now about how to interpret some voice hearing events that which we might call religious. So in many, many of the great religions, people hear the invisible other speak. So Augustine became a Christian, was able to convert because God spoke to him. Paul heard, you know, Saul heard God speak on the road to Damascus and was transformed and became Paul, and arguably had created the Christian religion. These voice hearing events are not uncommon in many parts of the world. So are they psychotic or not? Well, to even ask that question means that you really have to hold clearly in your mind the idea of a psychotic continuum, so that some people are not ill, but they have psychotic-like symptoms. I actually think that there are many paths to voice hearing that are not all associated with psychosis. I think some of them are, but I think some of them are associated with imagination, with a vivid inner world. I mean, we know that Charles Dickens talked about his characters speaking audibly to him. People have these experiences on the edge of sleep. And I think that people have these experiences, more likely to have these experiences if they've been traumatized. So there are many pathways. And that's another thing that's sometimes hard to, you know, keep in mind. The clinicians are trained to treat all of these experiences as potentially associated with illness. I don't think all of them are.
Which is also the whole clinician approach is also a Western creation, Western culture.
So. Well, I mean, that's the job of the clinician. People are coming to the clinician because they fear that something is wrong. It's just also the case in a Western setting. Sometimes people have these experiences and they worry that they're crazy. And so I'd be willing to argue that Americans, and arguably other Westerners, but I feel most confident talking about Americans, although that's a huge category. And you know, I think Americans have a harsher psychosis and less spiritual experience than people in other parts of the world, because of the way they pay attention to the kinds of events that become identified as voices.
Well, let's bring in this idea. Andrew Ryder, in one of the papers that you sent over, you talked about cultural scripts as guidance. You talked about cultural preservation as important. How would you fit these in with what we're talking about?
Well, in terms of the cultural script or the cultural model idea, this is sort of a way where we can think about meaning, as both Tanya and Roberto emphasized. In a given community, given cultural context, there can be these sort of consensually held models or scripts. These might describe things that are relatively normal, and it's actually good to attend in a cultural context what's considered normal as well, because the abnormal, of course, is always in relation to the normal. You know, how do you, you know, to banal examples, how do you go to a restaurant? Get a little closer. How do you go to a healthcare professional? And you can also have scripts or experience. What happens to someone? What's supposed to happen to someone if they lose their spouse? How does that play out? How long is that meant to take? Then you can have experiences that are clearly flagged as pathological or abnormal by that cultural context, and yet there's still some kind of understanding of what's supposed to happen. So, for example, we imagine, you know, we hear about Lady Macbeth, and now in the contemporary world, we say, ooh, that must be OCD. She's washing her hands. Because there's enough of a model of what that's about, even among lay people, among professionals, of a certain idea of how these syndromes are supposed to go. Now, Roberto mentioned recursive loops. And I think this is really important. And Tanya alluded to this as well, that the model is part of how we interpret what it is that's going on for ourselves, part of how we interpret what's going on for others, or even how we might model how we think others are going to see us if we're acting in a certain way. And the simple story there is just that, well, you know, something happens, and then you have a lens you see it through, and then you come up with some kind of interpretation. But it doesn't end there, because, of course, we interpret things in particular ways, and those ways have consequences, right? So the simple way would be something like we experience something in our body and then we interpret it. But the nature of our interpretation can have consequences for the body. And this is something psychologists talked about with panic attacks going back to the 1980s, that you feel something in your chest and you interpret it as, oh, I might be having something weird happening with my heart. But thinking something weird is happening with my heart isn't a neutral interpretation. You're not just reporting on the weather, right? You're actually having a thought that has autonomic arousal implications that can cause a whole bunch of physical experiences, including an increased heart rate. And the very fact that you experience that leads to a further interpretation. That further interpretation is probably a more freaked out interpretation than your original one. And round we go. And you end up with this feedback loop that we call a panic attack. Where the culture comes in there is that I actually think a lot of problems are like this. They are looped and they're recursive. And so when you study the cultural model, it's not just saying, oh, isn't it neat that people in country X think that our syndrome that we've carefully described in DSM is somewhat different. It's that the very fact that they think it is different is part of what makes it different. And you do have a different experience in
You know, something I read in your work dealt with how different cultures experience or express emotion as well, like sort of the Western culture having this kind of individualistic and sure, maybe internal looking, whereas other cultures, you know, wouldn't even consider identifying emotions.
I think there's the word has come up a few times, attention. What do we pay attention to? I think is really important. And, you know, we're very limited beings, and we live in incredibly complex physical and social universes. And it, you know, it's good if I can pay attention to what you're saying and not the truck backing up outside or the sound of the heating system and so on. So I focus on you, I attend to you, and I've learned that, you know, that's the best way to have a good conversation. If something really dramatic happened, my attention would switch over to that. So what is it we pay attention to? We got this tiny little fragment of existence that we can spend the resources paying attention to? Do we pay attention to the body, social world? Should I be studying the social world to figure out where's an opportunity for me to show off about my latest accomplishments? Or should I be scanning the social world to see whether what I'm doing is making people nervous or uncomfortable, and maybe I ought to tone it down or change how I approach people? Other people might think, well, I'm really, my main goal as a person is to promote myself to others. And that's a sort of North American individualism thing. You might spend relatively less time focusing on the nuances of other people's facial expressions. You go to a society like Japan, an awful lot of time is spent focusing on the nuances of other people's fairly subtle moods, gestures, behaviors, and so on. Because if you do that, and there's a consensus that everyone ought to be doing that, and you're looking at them and they're looking at you and all the rest of it, then there's a shared belief that this contributes to social harmony. And I say belief, but it's not necessarily something that everyone would be able to articulate as a belief. It's just that the society works that way. You can go to other places where people think, I really need to know what's going on in my body. I'm going to spend a lot of time focusing on that. It doesn't mean that they're accurately doing it, but it means that they're putting a priority on it. And so we've talked about how, for example, in depression, that to what extent are you supposed to be focusing on your thoughts and feelings and thinking of ways to communicate them? There's a kind of cultural value behind that. Okay. This is something, of all the things you could be focusing on, here's something worth focusing on and maybe worth communicating, at least to close others. Because you think if you do so, it'll have certain implications that you want, or at least that you can live with. In another society, there may be different implications to focusing on something. And why not focus on the things that help us survive and thrive in the social worlds we happen to live in? You know, that's actually being functional, but being functional is different in different places.
When we come back,
how does your culture affect your mental health or your mental illness? We spend the hour with three top scholars.
Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about cultural influence on mental illness. Is it culture all the way down, or biology all the way up, or some combination of the two?
Roberto Luis Fernandez, let's bring you back in, because you've also looked at depression and you've also looked at trauma and how these different cultures respond to both of these phenomena. How would you articulate the things you found there?
I was thinking, as the last comments that Andrew was making, about how in many ways all of these different ways of being and the different interactions between the individual people in it and their social context and the traditions that those social contexts emerge from, that's all ways of being human. None of them should be privileged. They're all different ways of behaving in response to different kinds of experience. And we just happen to have a particular construction of them that is, you know, peculiar, if you will, to our historical tradition and our particular setting and the patterns societally that shape us. So where my mind went in terms of the work I've done in depression, trauma, and other things, anxiety, was into classification, because I've done a fair amount of work on that. If you wanted to, if there was such diversity of being human, and being human was not one or the other, but the combination of them all, if you will, then how could you ever produce a classification system that was fair, if you will, for everybody? And the answer is that it's very difficult. Perhaps it's impossible. We've tried to do it as professions. There is a need for labeling pathology for all sorts of practical reasons. But there's also this great danger that you take one form of depression, for example, to give you the example that you gave, and you say that's the human way of becoming depressed, you know, emphasizing the mind rather than the body, or certain body experiences and not others. And if you have these others, then it's a little bit odd. Like we tend to think that in the US, for example, we tend to think that if somebody who's depressed starts attributing and speaking about their depression in the language of witchcraft, that perhaps they've gone off the deep end and they've lost it in a deluded kind of a way. Whereas in fact, the language of witchcraft is a whole complicated language of human interaction that can mean any number of things. It can mean paranoia, it can mean psychosis, but it can also mean sadness and separation and social exclusion and, you know, vulnerability, any number, you know, argument with your mother-in-law. I mean, it could mean any number of things. And if we only attribute one definition, one explanation to the words, you know, I think I've been bewitched or something like that, and we say, oh, you must be off the deep end because you're not making sense anymore, then we have limited a way of being human to one particular understanding of what that is. And in fact, I would argue much of the time it's a terrible misunderstanding of what people are trying to say. In fact, the people who are being fairly concrete, which is something that we psychiatrists label as a major insult to somebody. Oh, what a concrete person. You know, they're very focused on the here, on the, you know, the sort of superficial, they don't go into the deeper meaning of things. They're very concrete. We are the ones being concrete at that moment, because when they say I'm in the middle of a witchcraft situation, some sort of craziness, as opposed to them trying to explain a social interaction that they have a different label for and has that is quite subtle about who influences whom and how in which unspoken ways. So basically, there is a problem with classification. We have limited research. It's not like the world is awash in information and all the different ways that people all over the world experience these problems. You know, we have more and more information every day, thanks to the work of lots of our colleagues, more and more data on this variation, but we still need much more. And in the meantime, we produce systems of classification that try to be as open as we can make them, but they are hypotheses. They are the best we can do at the moment. They're labels for things that are incomplete.
There are so many different directions I could go with what you just said, but I do want to ask you what I had originally intended to ask about particularly trauma and responses to trauma, because I saw some of your work related to PTSD and different cultural responses to that. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about trauma and responses to trauma first before I then take off on another tangent.
Sure, I'll try to be brief.
It's okay.
It's a big topic. I would just say that what we label trauma, which is essentially an overwhelmingly terrible adverse experience that really marks us, has a terrible effect on our bodily integrity sometimes, but also the meaning that we ascribe to the world, our sense of safety, our sense of self. These experiences, they are patterned, meaning the way we interpret them, even what counts as trauma, is patterned by our position in the world, our society, our gender, our age, our race, ethnicity, language, religion, you know, any number of experiences, characteristics of ourselves, pattern how we understand what is traumatic and how we respond to what is traumatic and what we think ought to be done about the experience and response and in terms of being helped. Obviously, there are things that are awful for everybody, you know, but the degree of awfulness, if you will, even of the things that are horrible for everybody, varies. So if there's a study that I like to mention, for example, about Tibetan monks and nuns who, when they compare their experience of religious persecution in Tibet against their experience of being tortured, they sometimes, many of them, ascribe greater suffering to their experience and greater impairment to their experience of religious persecution than to their individual experience of torture, partly because of what the experience of religious persecution means. It's something even more awful, in a way, in that world's mind than the individual experience of torture. Obviously, torture is horrible. Nobody's arguing that somebody didn't find it very bad. The question is, to what effect does it have? It's very different to go to war and be in combat if you feel discriminated, alone, that you don't have the backing of your buddies, that you're fighting an unjust situation, that you actually empathize with the enemy more than you empathize with your own side. This is a very different experience of war and the effect of combat than in somebody who goes in with a better support system, a certain understanding of the situation that enables them to cope better. And everybody knows this, which is why we now have these movements to really support the troops and do all sorts of things about it, because we recognize as a society that these things matter. So trauma is one of these examples, to conclude. Trauma is one of these examples where even in something that looks obvious, everything, you know, everybody would agree X is terrible, the subtlety of the experience matters tremendously, because you may end up reacting differently, and you may end up seeking different help and identifying the problem as one kind of thing or another, depending on what sense you make of your experience.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Actually, I started to wonder as you were talking about the nuns and the monks, about how much of that was related to the attack on identity.
Identity is one element. And also a sense of communally, very important element, but another, I think, is a sense of communally held value. If you in some ways, you're a member of a group, and that sense, your identity is important, and probably that's what you mean. And within that, in a sense, there's that idea that there are things that matter much more than others. And when you see those attacked, it has a much stronger effect.
And this, I think, links into something else. Tanya, I think I saw this in your work, which was this idea of sort of social defeat, or I've heard it phrased, maybe even social death in some cases. How would you tie that all up?
So I think that what becomes salient for people is the way in which they're able to thrive in the world. Social defeat is the observation that when people are impaired with schizophrenia, what is becomes costly for them is the way in which they label themselves, they have an illness, but what becomes costly for them is the way in which they label themselves, the way in which they were able to work productively in the world, the way in which others are able to engage with them, whether they live in a place they find to be safe. Different understandings of safety and identity will shift in different social worlds. But I think that what all of us have been saying are that the things that seem obvious to us from our own perspective are not necessarily fundamental in the way that we believe that we are. So there's this whole old adage that you can't ask a fish about the water because that is what they swim in. And I think that there are many assumptions within a Western biomedical setting about what mental illness is, how we should treat it, how we should deal with it, that are costly for people. I mean, for example, just even labeling people. I think one of the things that we don't appreciate about the experience of schizophrenia is that for some people, the voices are terrible, the cognitive dysfunction is difficult. But the label of schizophrenia is a kind of social death. It means that there is something broken about your brain, which is the center of your identity, which is who you are. And that label can be terribly difficult for people. It's not clear how we solve some of these problems, because there are some of these cultural contexts in which people feel put down, they feel unaccepted, they feel harmed by their experience, because so many of these features run so deeply. Westerners have a view of reality that's remarkably categorical, very concerned about whether something is there or not there. And when people carry a diagnosis, then it's somehow there. It's like it's a tombstone. You can't kind of reach in your hand and just wiggle around pieces of culture. in ways that we would want to. But we can develop greater empathy. We can think about ways in which to intervene that will not generate particularly costly understandings for those that we care about.
I think this was also in your work. You talked about experiences that might compound something like schizophrenia or something like these types of disorders, as well as epigenetic factors because of how our genes turn on and off. And I think one of the examples you talked about was being bullied. Can you integrate some of that into your thoughts?
Well, I think until recently, particularly one of the history of psychiatry was that psychiatry was sort of dominated by the psychoanalytic model for many decades in this country until biomedical psychiatry assumed a more central place in our understanding. And one of the central features of schizophrenia, but schizophrenia under its psychoanalytic model was sometimes understood by clinicians as the result of a schizophrenogenic mother. There was kind of bad treatment within the home. There was a cold, unloving mother who gave ambiguous, conflicting signals of love and non-love. And then when biomedical psychiatry emerged, many clinicians understandably revolted against this notion that there were social consequences to intimate relationships. I think that one of the big revolutions in psychiatric science, as I've seen it over the last couple of decades, is this understanding of the kinds of things my colleagues have been talking about, of this, the impact of the social experience. We know now that people who've been bullied when they're young, people who've had experience of sexual abuse or emotional abuse or physical abuse, they're at greater risk of developing these psychiatric disorders. There's something very powerful about our social experience that leads to these, that has an impact on experiences that you know, our psychiatric science three decades ago really wanted to see as somehow based in the brain and is not created by social relationships.
Andrew Ryder, let's bring you back in because this sort of connects back to some of your comments and some of your articles. There was one sentence in one of your papers where you were arguing against the idea that it was culture all the way down, that it was also biology all the way up. And this seems to connect with what Tanya is saying.
It's interesting. When I'm in my department, I'm in the psychology department, and we have good neuroscience here. And I'm a bit of the cultural outlier, always pushing, you know, there's more culture than you think. Yep, even cognition. Yep, even perception. Yep, even you know, there's fields of cultural neuroscience and neuroanthropology. And I try to push that. But when I go into the interdisciplinary world of culture and mental health, I sometimes find myself in arguments where I'm the psychologist in the room, and I think my psychiatrist colleagues have similar experience, where we're saying, well, hold on a second. It's not an absolutely open field where culture can take you in any conceivable direction. The body makes some things more likely to happen and some things less. The brain has evolved in certain ways, not ways that make depression always the same everywhere, but ways that make some manifestations more likely. I give my example I gave you before about you interpret the chest pain, you feel fear, the chest pain gets worse because you've had an autonomic nervous system reaction. And you can find other cultural contexts in where people have a cultural model where they're afraid of different physical sensations. And if those physical sensations worsen because of your concern about having them, you can have a kind of a panic attack with a completely different locus in the body. So on the one hand, this is a profoundly cultural idea, right? Something that you'd call a panic attack could be about totally different body parts. And yet, I suspect that you're only going to see this pattern if it's a physical sensation that is then amplified by the autonomic arousal system responding to a particular negative interpretation. Right? So it's not anything goes. Muscle tension, chest pain, headaches, those kinds of things can be amplified. kind of tickly sensation in your elbow have the same consequence for the autonomic arousal system? The autonomic arousal system is not infinite. It functions in a particular evolved way. There is simultaneously, because of the importance of interpretation and meaning, there is this incredible number of different possibilities. And yet I'd say there's an even greater number of possibilities that you're not going to see anywhere.
I suppose also that there is argument now that these experiences actually do change you physiologically. For example, the things Tanya was talking about, whether it's bullying or abuse or the trauma that Roberto was talking about, that these things actually do have also an effect on our bodies. And then there's sort of this work that is also arguing that our bodies store memories. So I suppose you can't really separate any of this.
No, right. I think that's the whole point.
Exactly. I think that is the whole point, yes.
That's what I was making, that if we somehow focused only on one of the interactive elements, we'll always be confused. It's always an interaction of interpretation and the body. And the difficulty is, how do we isolate one element or the other without doing violence to the actual totality of the experience? We keep getting confused by finding the input of other variables that are not in the model, basically. But it's also true that it's very hard to then include them in the model, because you can't have a model that goes on forever with 100 different inputs. You can never find your way through it. So that's the dilemma we're in, isolating the key elements without ignoring, having both focus on important elements and inclusion of the various elements that are important.
So Roberto, how do we then take on treatment, healing, recovery, given the spaghetti factory that you just described?
I think one element that our work, and it's not just mine, but it's of a whole group, has taken, is taking the lead from the person. It's essentially a way of doing person-centered medicine, if you will, or healing, that takes into account culture. So one way we do it is by doing these kinds of individualized cultural assessments, where we ask the person or the person's family or both, we ask them their sense of what's going on. What do they think has caused it? What do they think needs to happen now? What have they tried? What worked? What didn't work? We call it a cultural formulation, or to develop a cultural formulation and do it through a thing we developed, an interview called a cultural formulation interview. So it's taking the lead from the people who are experiencing the suffering to get a sense of their own models, and their context as well. It's not all in their, head and their traditions. It's also in their social world. And try to use that to pattern the care, to negotiate care with them, and to see also their constraints as well as their strengths.
Andrew Ryder.
Just add to that. I'm glad Roberto said person-centered. I think once you're back in the clinic, the Achilles heel of a lot of older ways of thinking about culture, even by people who really took culture seriously, is that the big goal was going to be you'd have a book, or maybe you'd have a whole library, and if the Japanese person walked in, you'd run over to your bookshelf, maybe between clients, and you'd flip through the book, and in there would be the collected research of what we know that Japanese people do. This is not only impractical, but it's not the right way of thinking about culture. So when we do the research, I always think about it as, it's not, as a clinician, the research doesn't tell us how to treat a particular culture, because people aren't just reducible to their cultural identities. What it does do is broaden the range of possibilities that I need to consider. So if I do my research in China about physical symptoms, as a clinician, what that tells me is, no matter who I'm talking to, I should be more attentive to physical symptoms. If I work with someone for the first time who has lots of profound religious experiences, then, as a researcher, I might learn, hey, that's interesting. This part of the world has a higher percentage of people who have that experience. So that's worthwhile. But once one of those people is in my office, I need to know whether they're having that experience. And there might be someone who then comes into my office who's from a group that's small enough that no one has gotten around to studying them. But that research on religious experience makes me, I hope, a more skillful considerer of possibilities. So I see a lot of this work. It's not training me to have more answers as a clinician. It's training me to ask better questions.
I might have seen this in your work, Andrew. I can't remember which of yours talked about sort of the concept of honor and how that might flip with, you know, shame, and how that might then relate to the discomfort that might be defined as mental illness. And then, of course, Roberto was talking about the idea that we even say mental illness is sort of a cultural construct. So the things that might just feel really bad in one setting, bringing about something like depression or shame or maybe even a PTSD, might not do that somewhere else?
I haven't done research myself on honor. I may have mentioned it in passing in reviews of the literature more generally. But it's, honor is an example of just that people live in particular moral universes. Certain things are good and important and valued and beautiful and true and so on.
If you are, you know, in line with those things, then you are fine. But once right. You are malaligned with some of those things, then you might have those distress symptoms.
Right. You will understand your own experience as being out of alignment. And if you don't, there's plenty of other people around to tell you that you're out of alignment. And you that could make you unhappy. Not every deviation is psychopathology, right? So political activists, artists, all kinds of people that can rub against the grain, and it would be a real problem to say.
And like it.
Yeah, they don't fit. They might even be suffering, but they're not necessarily mentally, we would be quite dangerous to say that they're necessarily mentally ill. Nonetheless, I think when you're working with a patient, you do have this sense that they live in a particular moral universe, and some emotions are good and some are bad. And maybe there's a particular construction of masculinity, let's say, and that construction is not a huge fan of shedding tears, and that might make the psychotherapy experience scary, or it might have caused a particular emotional holding in rather than a letting out, or the emotions come out as anger and the anger has led to particular consequences. And I might be working within a different cultural framework that I haven't adequately questioned. I just think certain things are organized in a natural way. And so I need this, I guess, intercultural training, whether it's research or clinical, to sort of decenter me from my own set of assumptions so that I could say, again, not, oops, they're from a culture of honor, that means X, but I better spend more time learning about the moral universe this person functions in. And tools like the cultural formulation interview, other tools, for example, locally, we have a very long but interesting McGill illness narrative interview, are ways of spending time with someone, getting to know them, and teaching us to be a better answerer, a better asker of questions, a better listener to the answers that we hear.
Final thoughts, Roberto Luis Fernandez?
Well, I think it's very difficult for clinicians because they are asked to really experience the person and at the same time to keep in mind all sorts of external elements and information that they bring. Jaspers used to call it a bold swinging, that the person had to swing boldly between their own external understanding, the larger picture, what they bring as clinicians, and swing back into the experience of the person, put themselves into the person's own shoes and see the world that way. And it had to be done boldly. You know, you really had to give room to both of them. And it's very hard, you know, to keep in mind all this information without falling into stereotypes. So, you know, as Andrew said, if a person walks in and you start to pigeonhole them in some way, some of that is useful, some of that is not useful. You know, you want to hear some possible categories and go, I wonder if they're somatizing. But you don't want to assume, you know, that they're a somatizer because they come from a particular place. You want to keep some things in mind. So it's always good to ground it. What the work we've been doing recommends is to ground it in the conversation with the person and have knowledge. You don't want to go in blind. You want to understand the language even they're speaking. If you don't speak that, I don't just mean literally. Obviously, if you don't speak Spanish, you don't understand a Spanish speaker, but you also may not understand the meaning of certain words. You may think you understand and they mean something else by what they're saying. It's like witchcraft was the word I used before. This is a language that you may not speak, if you will. And so you have to have knowledge, but you also have to be willing to put it aside and swing boldly into the person's experience, detaching from the language, from the information you bring, so that you can appreciate it from their perspective, and then swing back. And you keep doing that throughout the entire process of therapy, bringing what you know and what your experience is as a therapist, and then also checking, and more importantly, maybe finding out what they feel and think and have experienced.
Well, this has just been an extraordinary conversation. I thank you both very much. And also Tanya Luhrmann, who had to leave us a little bit early. Thank you so much for sharing your research and your wisdom with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks very much for having us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been great fun. Thank you. Roberto Luis Fernandez is professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, director of New York State Center of Excellence for Cultural Competence and Hispanic Treatment Program, co-director of Anxiety Disorders Clinic at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. He's also the author and co-editor of the book DSM-5R, Handbook of the Cultural Formation Interview, and co-author of the publications Impact of Motivational Pharmacotherapy on Treatment Retention Among Depressed Latinos. Tanya Marie Luhrmann is the Watkins University professor in the anthropology department at Stanford University. She's the author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. Of Two Minds, an anthropologist looks at American psychiatry and our most troubling madness, schizophrenia and culture. Andrew Ryder is a professor of psychology and co-director of the Center for Clinical Research in Health at Concordia University. He's the author of Revisioning Psychiatry, Cultural Phenomenology, Critical Neuroscience, Global Mental Health, Depression and Cultural Context, Chinese Somatization, and Toward a Cultural Clinical Psychology. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.